RN, your world unfolding.
G'day, this is Paul Barclay. Welcome to Big Ideas on RN and on the web at abc.net.au/radionational. What do you think? Is overseas aid worth it? In order to get the budget back into surplus, the federal government has delayed by 1 year its commitment to increase foreign aid spending to 0.5% of GDP. The move has outraged overseas aid groups in Australia, though the aid budget will still increase by more than $300 million to about $5.15 billion this financial year. But as a percentage of GDP, it remains static at 0.35%. Ever since the GFC, there's been increasing pressure to cut Australia's overseas aid. But what would this mean for poverty-stricken regions, particularly in the Asia-Pacific, which is where 70% of Australia's foreign aid is spent? Well, let's go to Federation Square in Melbourne, where the Archbishop of Melbourne, Dr. Philip Fryer, discusses the value of overseas aid with two guests. Valerie Browning, an Australian-born nurse and midwife who for 35 years has devoted her life to the people in the Horn of Africa. And Dr. Jonathan Cornford, aid researcher and advocate who works for the independent Christian organisation Mana Gum. Philip Fryer starts the discussion with some basic definitions.
This question about development, I think it's probably important we look at what development is first. I understand that we've got about $180 billion that are spent internationally on development aid, and about $4 billion of that comes from Australia. So, Valerie, what's your take on what development is, and I guess maybe what it isn't, but what it is first?
This is the vital question, and I'm glad you've raised it first, because it sets the groundwork for what we can talk about later. Development is the process whereby people look after their own agenda in a process of empowerment to move forward in their own vision. So, I mean, development can be at any level with a single child in the house, but with us it's with a whole community, which is a collection of people. So the vital issues are, it's in their hand, the agenda, they're driving it, and they're getting the empowerment they require to continue on in a sustainable way. That's really what it's about, I think.
Jonathan, how do you look at that question of what development is?
Well, I guess I have a little bit of a different take. I really like Valerie's version of what development is or could be or should be. But actually, when we think about what the main conception of development is out there in the development world and which drives the development industry, it's actually quite a different idea. It's largely an idea that is a predetermined goal about where societies should go. And, you know, there's all sorts of complex, you know, different takes on that. But to bring it down to a crude level, a simple level, in a lot of ways, development really, for a lot of people, is helping other people to live like us. So there's this idea of social development that basically all societies will follow a common path, and that's industrialised economic growth. And it's a predetermined course, and I think that's a problematic view of development. But it's probably the dominant one in the development world, I would say. But there are other conceptions which we need, such as Valerie's, which look at the word, what does it mean for someone, either a person or a community or even a country, to develop its potential, guided by its own, along its own lines.
So I think, Valerie, I've seen probably an example of those two conceptions not far from you, that new dam on the Awash River that was being built by, I think, Chinese injection of funds, the Ethiopian government, a seasonal river in really, for much of the year, what is quite arid country, being dammed so that there can be flood irrigation of sugarcane being grown. And, you know, I know just when I was there at the time that was coming near completion, and how it had displaced a lot of the pastoralists from their probably more productive river areas where they could retreat to. And just talk us through that, because that's someone's conception of development in the middle of the area you're concerned about.
Well, that must be described as macro development. It's nowhere near the community, and this is the horrific thing we're going through. That dam was opened in 2008. It's 35 kilometres long, and it's irrigating 60,000 hectares, and they still want more land. The land is used, as you say, by the pastoralists for their grazing of their animals. And now we are facing the marginalisation of communities who never knew the word thirst. They're coming into our office and saying, please, please help us. You know, we can't continue. We've just assessed a community which we thought was doing well in the Afar society. They've now got severe acute malnutrition. And this is because of the sugarcane displacement.
Yep. So there's 38 kilometres of dammed water, but people, the pastoralists, they've got less water security. This is the cruel paradox for them.
Indeed. The dam is channeling water. I mean, I'm not an engineer, God. And they made huge mistakes. They made the channeling things too narrow. They flooded back in... That was in August of 2010. Overnight, 56,000 households had to flee because water, a massive wall of water hit them. It was just awful. You've got a situation where it looks like more water, more availability. In fact, it's less. A pristine land called the Kutubla, which used to have so much bird life, so much wildlife, and all the trees that we love best in the Afar region, is now dried up. And those people are really in problem. What to do, what's the next step in their life, is really hard to say.
And Jonathan, from your experience, in an even a different context, how unusual is that kind of a situation?
Unfortunately, it's not unusual at all. So there's very similar stories in Southeast Asia, entirely different region of the world, entirely different context, but basically the same story of development being a struggle over resources, particularly land, but also rivers, forests, you know, soil even. The process of development has often been one of a change in ownership of who actually gets to access those resources, and often it's changed from a model of access to a resource to ownership of a resource by someone who then develop it. In the region of the world which I've worked most, Laos and Cambodia, damming is one of the major drivers of economic growth, and rivers are becoming privatised sources of funds, but other people are losing out in very similar ways and in very significant ways.
But when these, so look, if you look at these big projects, which I presume are funded by World Bank funds, I presume Australia's involved somehow in some of these investments, I don't know, you could probably tell us. But when people are doing these things, how do they end up with these consequences? Because you'd imagine that, you know, the motivation, you know, decent people would want to see the lives of ordinary people improved, not made worse by something that seems to be an intervention that you'd think would be for the better. How do we end up in that situation?
Oh, it's a very good question. I mean, it's the great human question of how we end up in these situations, the role of aid in these situations. Yep. In Southeast Asia at the moment, probably there's not... Most of these dams are being built with private investment. There is some aid money going into some dams in some places, particularly from institutions such as the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. But certainly, over the longer period of time, the aid money, particularly through the World Bank and including from governments like Australia, has supported and even promoted this model of development. In fact, it's the World Bank and the Asian Development that laid the template for how Laos and Cambodia could develop hydropower to basically turn a profit. And it's now being developed by private developers, so they often don't have direct control over those particular projects, over what happens. But they certainly set in place the models and even some of the policies and structures that have enabled that to take place. Their view is that hydropower, for Laos, they would consider it a country that's a basket case economy, few comparative advantages in the global economy. One thing they do have is lots of fast-flowing rivers. If we can turn these to make a profit, that's revenue going into government coffers, that's tax revenue, royalty revenue, and sometimes the government's a stakeholder in the project. That's money that they can, revenue for government, that they can then spend on poverty alleviation. The problem is they've often significantly underestimated the extent of the change that those projects bring to people who they would otherwise classify as poor, and the extent of both sociological and ecological change and what that means for communities and people. So there's just a divergence of worldviews going on.
I don't know how much this dam in the Awash has cost. I won't dwell on that too much. It would be a vast amount of money. Valerie, tell us, you know, like $10,000... what can be achieved through the kind of methods that APDA, the Pastoralist Development Association, uses? You know, or pick a number, you know, what can actually be achieved through funds of that scale?
$10,000 is a lot of money for us. That keeps going probably a team of 20 literacy teachers for a whole year and probably gets them through their annual refresher training as well and that sort of thing. And those teachers, of course, are enabling the community to read and write and go on into the education system. And this is something that's absolutely vital in that only 10 years ago we started education with these pastoralist people. 10 years ago, our people were 2% literate. And so this is part of the reason why we've got this Awash Dam, is that people are disempowered. They weren't part of the decision making. They didn't say, oh yes, we can give away this water course, we don't need it. Or, yeah, move in, let's have more people here. Pastoralists think very differently. They balance and balance and balance things. And they weren't part of decision making. They're illiterate. Nobody's going to take them into a discussion process. And with their traditional knowledge, they're considered backward or, you know, not capable of doing that, which is very tragic.
As I understand it, APDAR has many overseas partners, which generates, as I've observed at visiting you, a great deal of compliance work and reporting and interacting with all sorts of people from all around the world. And most of the funding you get is fairly small-scale funding. It's not big funding like these other big macro projects. It doesn't have a comparison, really, does it?
No, that's right. And it's not, I mean, you say funding. It's not just funding that an organisation that we look for. It's really deliberate partnership where people in another country, such as Australia, such as one of the European countries, know the AFAR and care for them, visit them, and want to see that process of them being empowered and get excited as we get, the same excitement. And so, for example, I've got a group of 13 women in the middle of Germany who raise money for education for us. And they're doing a great job, and we love them. And they come and visit, and that's the best. And so, yes, we're connected with many of the European countries, but I would want to add that as your part of the world has gone into economic crisis or uncertainty, then of course we've had the downturns in particularly 2008, 2009. I got lots of emails which said, please refine all your budgets, go down, go down, go down. And we were hitting inflation, basic household inflation. And so, I mean, now Ethiopia's inflation runs at 25%. And this side of the world is saying, no, 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 we must curtail things. So it's not easy. We're in a race of difficulty.
And Jonathan, for how you've understood these whole aspirations, there must be an attraction sometimes into even a commercial arrangement or a partnership with government, because large amount of funds can relatively easily placed in big infrastructure projects. Small amounts of funds that probably more grassroots organisations need just to get the accountability, the reporting back, the knowledge that's happening, that must be much more complicated. If you're trying to disperse $1 billion in $10,000 lots, it must be, you know, for a donor entity, much harder than, say, building a dam or a highway.
Precisely. It's actually much harder to spend money well to other people's benefit than people think. So often there's a conception, if we've got some money, let's just send it there and that's going to help. And actually, things are not that simple. It doesn't work that easily. It takes an organisation like Valerie's, and with its knowledge and its embeddedness, what a wonderful picture of what can be done with $10,000. Another picture of what could be done with $10,000 is you could pay a couple of consultants for a couple of weeks to do a vulnerability assessment in an AFAR. That will cost you $10,000 too. That's another way you could spend it, and in a way in which it is being spent in the development world. Look, it is hard to spend money well. So there's a problem of just administrating money and the cost of it, and certainly the attraction, and the aid industry is moving to want to spend larger bundles of money. So AusAid is trying to increase its, whenever it spends money, it wants it to increase the average amount of that because it's cheaper. But also it's a question of worldview and conception. Well, actually, what are we trying to facilitate? So in one idea of development, larger amounts of money to certain sorts of projects will create the sorts of economic growth that some people understand to be as a solution to poverty. whereas other sorts of projects take a lot more effort to produce change, even for smaller amounts of money.
What does poverty look like from an Afar perspective? Because probably external people from the West, looking at the whole of Afar society, probably think that's what poverty is, but presumably if you're in the society, that's not... The life of Afar isn't poverty, as people understand themselves.
Poverty, and I've had the privilege of knowing it because I'm married to an Afar for 23 years, and I consider that the best privilege, is actually disempowerment. So you are not in charge of your own agenda. You're frustrated. You're saying, oh my God, please don't do that. And you've got no avenue to address the question. You can't do it. Nobody's going to listen to you. And that's what poverty is all about. And then, because you're not in charge of your agenda, then you get the things you don't want. So you get dirty water to drink. You are unable to find an access to put your children into school. You simply die of malaria because there's no mosquito nets. And you are certainly at high risk of death in child delivery, in the birth of a child. Those things are consequences. Lack of food is a consequence, but it's not actually poverty itself. Nobody chooses to be hungry. It's not possible. And they don't choose either to not put their children in school. It's not because they're not interested in education. Everybody wants to learn. You know, you just show somebody a mobile phone, I mean, they go crazy. They, you know, let me get into this thing, you know, flick, flick, flick. But the systems aren't there. They're not using your language, for example, and that's a big one. And so you can't get in. You've got no way of getting in. You're having to learn in a foreign language. And the language comes the culture. It's very difficult.
And I suppose we start running into those conceptions of what a nation is, because people from perspective of Australia, we look at maps, we think Ethiopia is Ethiopia. It must have a government. It must have people who share an aspiration for the welfare of all its people. I mean, that's the kind of way, you know, if you grow up in a place like Australia, you broadly think that's how nations operate, but from my observation, you can't actually rigidly apply those concepts. You can't transfer them to other contexts like Ethiopia easily.
You're getting on to another tricky one, aren't you? The problem here is that the West has tried and still tries to blueprint this system of governance throughout the world. And really, this is really choking the development system. It's choking the aspirations and the visionary way which other countries, other people should work. Take the Middle East, take the part of Africa I live in. And so, yeah, we have this government, yes, who's been there since 1991. The Prime Minister's now, he's in his late 50s, so he's got years to go. We can expect to keep him, I guess. And basically, we had an election in May of 2010, and he got 98.9%. We have one man in an opposition parliament of 700 members, one man, not a party. And my regional president in Afar region got 100%. I mean, he scored very well. So, I mean, this is democracy working in our part of the world. It's mad. It's crazy. So, and what is Ethiopia? Ethiopia is 82 nationalities into one border. Nationalities, these are people with languages, with cultures, with heritages, with histories, and, you know, they talk about Ethiopia for 3,000 years. This is a fallacy in the first place. I mean, it was a bunch of kingdoms or fiefdoms, small groups of powerful little kings on horses, who fought each other and killed each other, quite frankly. And we got the borders. Yes, we got the borders through colonization, that's for sure. I mean, Djibouti was an enclave of the French. Eritrea was carved off at the River Merit by the Italians. Sudan taken over by the British. Poor old Somalia got cut up five ways. Italians, British and French and, yeah, well, and Ethiopia into the bargain, and then a bit into Kenya. I mean, it's crazy, you know. So, I mean, how would you want to govern that mess anyway?
This becomes a bigger political issue if we look at the way in which the rights of indigenous people, the rights of traditional landholders, perhaps, you know, need to be asserted, even in the midst of some of these other things like highways, dams, logging projects, the kind of things that give, in one conception of it, economic development. How do we tend as aid organisations, donor governments, to react to that grassroots empowerment of the kind that Valerie's talking about?
It's worth here at this point just clarifying some things about what we mean by aid. Probably a lot of what people think of when we talk about aid are as projects similar to Valerie's, or people going in and putting drinking wells in villages or doing agricultural projects. That's one part of the picture. So there's two main deliverers of aid. There's the, what we call official aid from governments and multilateral institutions, and there's non-government organisations, NGOs like World Vision, TIER, Oxfam, Anglicord, those sorts of agencies who deliver aid directly. By far the greatest proportion of that is official aid from governments, over 90%. And that's governments giving money directly to governments, or governments giving money to institutions like the World Bank, who then give money to governments. How they deal with those questions of particularly the most marginalised, indigenous groups or ethnic minorities, is very different. Groups who operate at the grassroots level are able to deal in very nuanced and careful ways around differences of culture, ethnicity, and are able to tailor their programs directly for those sorts of people groups. Governments dealing with governments, you've got a diplomatic issue there. So certainly the Australian government would encourage in its aid program proper treatment of ethnic minorities and Indigenous people, and that proper care be taken in development projects for those people. It doesn't have control over what those governments do, and it can only ever say so much about what a government in a country like Laos or Cambodia or Ethiopia is doing. It's got diplomatic conventions that it has to stick to. So they're much more constrained in actually how money they spend affects what is essentially a political economy dynamic between often different groups within a society, and how governments tend to represent some groups more than other groups. They can't play into those games too much, and so they can often find themselves in a bind.
And do you have any examples that relate to Australian AusAid-funded things where you've studied that or you've observed that we might find interesting?
I'd have to think a little bit. So certainly in the context of Laos, say for example, Laos is a highly ethnic diverse country. There's over 40 different ethnic groups, depending how you count them, 80 depending how you count languages. The most dominant group only represents about 40 to 50% of the population. So it's the large groups of the people who are non-Lao. They're the most disadvantaged groups. And so there's been a lot of effort by donors to say, actually, we need to get aid to these groups. They need more access to health services, drinking water, education, these sorts of things. One of the Lao government's main solutions from that is Laos is a very mountainous country, and a lot of the ethnic minorities inhabit the highlands and the mountainous areas, is to say, actually, well, it costs a lot of money for us to go and take things to those groups, and actually they're often outside of their control and they don't trust them. They have been insurgent groups in the past. We'd like to bring them down from the mountains into the lowlands, resettle them into larger clusters, and we want to change their agriculture from being people who do upland agriculture into sedentary, and that's all development. And the donors have, you know, in a simplified picture said, yes, well that's great, and then we can deliver services, and aid money has funded that. That has created, all framed in aid language, poverty alleviation language, that's actually created in what has been a slow burn humanitarian disaster for a lot of ethnic minorities. Being relocated from uplands to lowlands is a major life shift. They can't practice life the way they know it, essentially, and that had terrible consequences for many groups, and that's something that was not foreseen by a lot of aid donors. What they saw was services being delivered, and you could count the numbers of people who now had access to clean water, who now had access to a school. That showed up in the reports. And actually, by the MDG indicators, a whole bunch of things seemed to get better. The number count went up. But when you actually look at what happened on the ground, there was a different story.
That would ring bells with you, Valerie, for what you've seen in Ethiopia?
Absolutely. I mean, really and truly, this is... We humans don't learn, do we? I mean, it's just a historic repeat. Yeah. It's very sad. And again, yeah, little voices, little people, we can't be bothered with them. We're too fast. We want a quick answer. We want a formula to go in and do things very fast. At the moment, Ethiopia's got a very, internationally it's been questioned, I've seen it on the internet, a villagization scheme going on right now. And it's virtually that. I mean, what do you do with 82 nationalities? Well, you bring them together, you synthesize them, and they become one people. It's easy, but it's not easy.
Nurse and midwife Valerie Browning explaining the realities and difficulties of trying to lump together the many different cultures in Africa. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. We're looking at overseas aid and we're asking, how efficiently is the aid dollar being spent? Your guests are nurse and midwife Valerie Browning and aid researcher Jonathan Cornford, and they're rather critical. They're speaking with the Archbishop of Melbourne, Philip Fryer.
I imagine most of us who are here this morning, in some way or other, have been, well, we've either paid taxes, so we were part of the, by some extension, the AusAid engagements around the world. Probably most of us have been donors of some kind to NGOs. So we've got some motivations, which I'm sure, if you look at people in the room, and people will speak about their own motivations, I'm sure we come to a time to interact, we're actually wanting something that will be good for other people. It's disturbing that we hear a fairly bleak story, because in a sense we want to understand how things can happen whilst not quench this desire to see something good happen for other people. It's, how do you sort of see that? Because you communicate with people around the world, Valerie, about some of these things. How do you see that balance, you know, how we keep that together?
And I really thank you for raising that, because one of the most exciting things has come out of this country and your very government. I mean, we've started a thing called, and we're part of it through Anglicord, the Australia-Africa Community Engagement Scheme. And that word engagement is a key one for the objectives of the scheme. I mean, I've never seen this with another government. I've seen USAID projects by the dozen. I've not participated, but I've seen them, I've read them. CEDA Canada, CEDA Sweden, DFID Britain, etc., etc. But this one is really very interesting, and it comes, I wonder whether you know about it, that the AusAid did an assessment of their work in the Pacific Basin, the islands, and also in Southeast Asia, and they said they failed, so they wanted a different approach, and this is it, to try this one. The three objectives, the first one's obvious, that the community has access to services. Number two is that the Australian government actually learns how to engage with Africans. They're working in 10 African countries for this project. Ethiopia is one of them, and we are one of them, to develop policies which can mobilise development at the community level. And number three is that the Australian public know about it and they know where the money's going. So it's got really, really amazing objectives. I got so excited about this one. It started in July 2011. It's got a 5-year life cycle, and we're in it for safe motherhood. Water and sanitation is another line in it, and food security is the third one. But it's really fascinating. I mean, if the Australian government achieves this, I believe they can teach other countries. I do think that. Well, it's a learning process. We're in it with the Kenyans from our side. So we're cross-fertilising information and networking, and which is amazing. I mean, can you imagine 12 organisations getting together in one room? Ha ha! We're having to do that and work on the same formats for reporting. It's quite amazing. It's really quite something.
Jonathan, this sounds like a result of the 2006 white paper that AusAid did about community engagement. And
probably since then, probably more likely to have come about, you said from the Pacific. I know they did some studies around engagement with civil society in the Pacific. Mm. Was it coming out of that, or it could have been?
That's what they said in the first workshop I attended in Nairobi, that it was a result of their assessment. They'd seen that Australian money had not made the impacts they thought they would be able to, and they needed a different way.
There were some studies of technical assistance that went on after the white paper in the Pacific that showed this one way of giving aid is to put it crudely, often to send white people to tell non-white people what to do. It's called technical assistance. That's too crude, but, you know, there is some truth to it. There were some studies that showed actually we've spent very large amounts of aid on that. It hasn't been effective. That might be what you're referring to.
What's the work that will happen as a result of this engagement from AusAid, specifically with you, that you're going to be able to, what capacity will you have increased?
We've got now the opportunity, which we're grabbing hold of, to make an impact on not... We don't like MDGs, by the way. They should be cancelled. And it's a ridiculous thing that this thing was ever put on paper and decided upon by the year 2015 we'd have a new world. This is nonsense. But the fact that mothers die in childbirth is... There could be no greater tragedy. And we can't go into family planning because our children die under five at such an extreme rate, and particularly in the first year of life, and particularly around the birthing process. So if we can get a handle on that, we've got a handle on a lot of things. And this project's offering us that. And so we're doing very, very many innovative things. The project allows us, in fact, to change totally year by year if we need to, by the community demand. At the moment, just right now, a very small thing to you, I'm sure, but we're going to do for the first time a registration of every single pregnant woman on one card, and we'll follow her until she's a week past the delivery, document everything, and these actual cards will become part of our learning process of collection of information in the first place, but then a learning process of where we're going wrong, where the gaps are, and how to really seriously help these women. Believe it or not, there are more men in our society than women because of this in population count. This is a great opportunity. It's wide open. It includes actually food security because, I mean, pregnant woman's got to eat. And it's wonderful if women get money in their hand to make decisions about how to spend it. Yeah, it includes literacy, it includes clean water, etc.
I suppose the area of, as even, you know, societies engaging with other societies, our desire for this narrative of success, you might say, that we, you know, we all want to see something making a difference, you know, someone who was unhappy being happier as a result of our interventions, that's a kind of fairly natural human response. So I think we need that. It seems to be we want success, but in wanting that success, are we at risk of imagining that other people's societies, as we've heard, which are complex, are somehow less complex than they are? I'm just wondering, you know, as far as the people from countries who do give aid, or people who are donors, people like us who might be quite eager to see the amount of Australian GDP going in overseas aid increase, how do we balance these desires for ourselves and the real sense of measured outcomes at the other end that really are making an improvement to people?
That's very complex, but the one thing to say is that under the condition the world is in today, aid must increase if we want planet Earth at all. I mean, the whole world, we want it. You know, we don't want to chuck away the African continent. We can't. She's going to stay. So we can't then say, let's lessen GDP to our contribution to development, which is what the Norwegians have just done and other European countries are going through the debate of doing. And so the money available to assist is going down. This is going to be in itself for Africa another crisis, because for you to stabilize your economy and keep yourself happy anyway, you're taking from Africa. We've just had mining companies from Australia, from Canada, from all sorts of places walk in and say, we will mine the Afar region. Another problem we face. Okay. And so basically, we've got to keep balance. This is very, very hard. But at the same time, you can't expect results in a given period. I mean, we shouldn't be putting time frames there. I mean, we should look back at our own histories. I mean, I remember listening to my grandmother, and I thought she was a weirdo when I was a child, because she was talking about eating the most strange things, and how you treated a common cold for her was really, you know, I thought, oh, thank goodness, you're not my mother, I used to think to myself. And then my mother would put olive oil down, or some form of oil down my throat. You know, but these were, we've evolved through systems, you know, and then we've come into the tablets and we're in the pharmacy. But before, we were making our medicines in our homes, you know, and that's been a process. That's just one simple example. I mean, people shout and scream and say, female genital mutilation should stop now. What a lot of nonsense. I mean, it's a tradition of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years. It is not just that. It's the system of the way they marry, or the way they think of having a child, of balance between male and female in the family, male and female in the society. All that thinking is in the tradition. So you can't just, you know, illegalize this thing and stop it, which is what we've been told to do. If we're on these deadlines from the first world, you know, we're going to drop out today. But if the first world can walk with us and take patience with us, then all can be achieved, and there can be, yeah, a growing sense of partnership. But at the moment, they're driving us through a whirlwind which we can't keep pace to.
Yeah, it's a very big question, Philip, about how best aid money can be used. And it's a complex question, because certainly we want to make sure that money that is given as aid is not just wasted needlessly and frittered away, which it can easily be done. On the other hand, as Valerie says, how do we measure success? You know, what are the things that we use to measure success, and how quickly do we expect change to come? But there's probably a bigger question than that too, which is actually, what actually do we think in the bigger picture aid actually can do? Because I think while aid can be of enormous value and do incredibly important things, such as in Afar, there's been so many wonderful aid projects in the world, but aid actually can't be a solution to the world's problems. The suffering and hardship, deprivation in the world is primarily a product of the economic systems that we have, and they are being driven by a global economy of which we are a part. The mining boom, which produces for us laptops, mobile phones at massive amounts at very cheap prices, is a part of what's happening in the developing world, and that's driving changes in resources and affecting people. We have to take ownership of the bigger picture as well, that there's more in this picture than just aid. So poverty is not about us giving money to them, and that's, you know, and we can fix that. It's about a much bigger picture about how this thing works together, and we're a part of that. So our acts of consumption actually have an impact on this picture as well, not just our acts of aid giving money. In fact, probably our acts of consumption have by far the larger impact, and it's usually not, and it may not be a beneficial impact. So sometimes it can be, but so we need to look, we need to own the whole picture. If for people of faith, we want to take responsibility, actually, which is, I think, one of the core demands of faith for ourselves, then we need to look at the whole picture and not just aid.
Well, I think that's a good opportunity of opening up our discussion to everyone who's here this morning.
Peter Bradley. Australia has a large number of nationalities within itself, e.g., as we started today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, most of whom have need of assistance and aid themselves. From your experiences in aid in foreign countries with similar multinational situations, what insights could you bring to our own issues with Indigenous aid and development?
We see similar dynamics to those described. I mean, we've had a dynamic over the last generation, 25, 30 years of an increasing sense of homeland movements, of traditional Aboriginal identities being affirmed, people moving back to country, living in smaller groups. And we also see organisational pressures in the same way that have been described for the efficiency of the delivery of services, that they are more efficiently delivered to people who are gathered in communities, which often, because of the great diversity of identities, have far more attention than people living apart in groups where there is the natural unity of identity in a homeland group or in an extended family group. So I think the same forces are at work. I mean, clearly in Australia we have far better protection of Indigenous rights over land and resources than I think we've heard about in some other parts of the world. That wasn't always the case, but more recently it is the case in more recent generations. But I think that the principle that Valerie first said, which rephrasing it to me, is that anyone will achieve the kind of things that they feel motivated about. So I think whatever is conceived of as development, it has to engage with the owned motivations of the people who are sought to be encouraged to go on that journey and to find what motivates them, what their priorities are. And I think in Australia we still struggle to be as attentive and responsive to the kind of owned priorities of Indigenous people especially given the different nationhoods that exist amongst Indigenous Australia. So I think many of the issues have similarities, but there are some significant differences.
Warren Glover. Jonathan, you said that over 90% of aid goes through the official government to government, either directly or through the World Bank, such like. And the other kind of aid, through NGOs, is very effective on the ground. In what way can we encourage the Australian government to give more aid through NGOs?
Well, the simple answer, it is happening now. Actually, the Australian aid budget, I don't know if you know, has been actually growing rapidly over the last 4 or 5 years, and we'll see how things go in our current budgetary circumstances, but are predicted almost double by 2016. So there's very large growth in the aid budget, and so there's been increasing amounts go to NGOs, but actually there's also been an increasing proportion of the aid pie be delivered to NGOs. So that's actually gone up significantly too in the last 4 to 5 years, and it's still going up. So there's actually a lot of new money there for NGOs at the moment. We may even come to a point soon where there's absorption problems, a question about how much Australian NGOs actually can absorb from the rising aid budget. So it's growing rapidly at the moment.
My name's Heather Brown. I'm from International Women's Development Agency, and I have a question for Valerie. You've touched on it a bit, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the impact of gender and men and women in the work that you're doing.
My pleasure, and thank you for the question. It's a vital question, and it's very directly connected with the people I live with. They're a highly paternalistic society. They're Muslims. That doesn't make them paternalistic, but we have that perception, perhaps. And yes, as I said, only 10 years ago, education started. When we started education, we kept database of our female and male students. We started, I think, with 19 or less than 20% girl students or female students. We're teaching also adults as well. Now we have 43. So we must drive ourselves to balance. We must, and we do. You can't walk on one leg, that's stupid. And you can't develop with half the society, that's crazy. When doubly the problems fall on the head and the shoulder of the woman, you can't ignore her. I do remember in 1999 with my co-founders of this organisation, a group of 34, Afar and me, we're sitting around and I said to them, look guys, we're talking about maternal death, we're talking about the issues of women, but there are no women here. But they said, but you're here. I said, well, come on, I'm artificial, it's not going to work. We've got to get real Afar women in. They said, well, you can't. But I said, we're going to. And we did it. In 1999, we started this first school for women to learn to read and write. 36 people did it, and they came through wonderfully. From that, we chose 20 to be what we called women extension workers. We modelled and made a role for them in our development work. We had community teachers and health workers. We stuck in a third, women extension workers, and let them teach all the life skills to women in their own community. We started with 20 women. Today we have 280 of them. Yeah, we're creeping up the balance within our own organisation. It's a huge struggle. We're talking of all the issues, but it's the Afar talking it through themselves, through their religious leaders, through their clan elders, of how women can participate and can be part of every decision-making and can be leaders. Now we can talk about the fact that our organisation one day, we hope, we dream, will be led by a woman, and we will let her come in. But we couldn't have done that even 5 years ago. So there is a progress. We're going on. But we're a long way from reaching the point where we could say we're in balance. So, I mean, women are demanding, for example, rights in marriage now. And that was unheard of before. So a bright new future is coming. To get to see both sides of the view, the male and the female side, is absolutely essential in every part of our work.
Susanna Mason. Valerie, just like to know what is happening with the women pregnant women? Do they deliver out in the villages with village midwives? Do they come into the hospital? And are they giving birth early? Is that one of the problems? Or is it malnutrition? Or could you elaborate, please?
98 point well we don't know the point because we don't count very well, we don't do our statistics very well, but at least 98% deliver in the home. Where is the home? It is away in a very remote condition. Maybe there is no road. We've facilitated the community, should I say, to construct almost 700 kilometres of what we describe as feeder roads to get an ambulance in to get this poor woman. But of course, it's not always working and timing is very difficult. So in the process, we've trained now over 900 traditional birth attendants. And the thing is, with these traditional birth attendants, they are trained by their grandmother, by their mother, but they're mentored by their sister or whatever, and they become a birth attendant. They've got a cutting knife and no more. So we make for them delivery sets, which are very simple, costing 14 Ethiopian birr, which is less than an Australian dollar. And then basically, we retrain those 900 every single year. We keep contact with them. Our health workers work with them. Our women extension workers work with them. We've started the system for the first time of checking the mother in the pregnancy period. So our own government says that AFAR have 6% of their women checked in the pregnancy period. 6%. So we've got a long, long, long way to go. And at the top of the pinnacle, which is very exciting, with the help of a group of people in New South Wales, and I think probably the Victorians were involved, I have to say that, don't I? We opened a new hospital in Millay. The new Australian ambassador to Ethiopia actually did the opening on 24th of September 2011. And this is an emergency obstetric hospital, so we've got somewhere where we can do a cesarean section now, but we're still a long way to go, and we're trying hard to lower that maternal death. One of the issues that is lowering it is getting those traditional birth attendants to stop six traditions that kill in childbirth. And once they realise that this is absolutely illogical, they do stop. They laugh about it. They say, my golly, I mean, look at the logic. They think it's magic to breastfeed as soon as the baby comes out. But of course, that lets out the placenta. You're saying, so she doesn't die of bleeding. Simple as that. There's so many simple solutions. Obstetrics is so logical. It's wonderful.
My name's Deborah Story. I'd like to ask you to comment on how Christian faith inspires our vision for the common good of the world. I'm thinking that the Archbishop was criticised for talking about what might be good for Australia, and I'm wondering how our faith, for those of us who are Christian, informs our vision of what development should be and how the dignity of different nations and cultures might be respected in that.
My name is Ian Barnes. I have a very similar question to Deborah. Valerie, could you tell us what role Anglican communities or congregations play within the processes of people-centred development? And do you see a potential for linkages between those communities and, say, Anglican congregations within countries like Australia? We talk mainly about more professional government and NGO connections, but is there potential for much more grassroots level?
The people-to-people connection. You can't all jump on the plane and end up in Addis and I pick you up at the airport, but I could do that. This is all very possible and you're welcome. I shouldn't be sitting here. There should be an AFAR in this chair, you know? Whether a woman, whether a man, it doesn't matter. But we need to literally get to the conversation level with these people. We've got too many presumptions in our brain about people of another culture, another faith even. I live with Muslims, and can you believe it? They are the most peace-abiding people that you could ever dream to live with. And they hate violence, hate it, abhor it, cry when there's news on the radio of violence in a place like Iraq or somewhere like that. So having said that, what do you do? You've got the internet, you've got other things. We have to connect, we have to talk, and what a wonderful occasion this is today, and thanks to you great guys for organising it. But yeah, we have to meet each other face to face. We're never going to agree on every issue, but who does agree on every issue? That's the great thing of life, isn't it? The going on, the dialogue, the discussion. But we can enrich ourselves by a better understanding. As an Australian, I'm 100% better off than you guys because I live in the kitchen and the bathroom of the Alpha. That's my benefit, you know? And I know exactly day by day. I have to live with it. I have to reckon with it every single day. So this is a great privilege I have. We have to take away the divides of the world. And the Anglicans can do it. The church people can do it. The people who have faith can do it. Because they trust in God. I mean, dying is no problem. It's great, in fact. And so from that point of view, risks should be taken. We should be out there, not saying, oh my goodness, my insurance company won't let me go there. I mean, for heaven's sake, come. I mean, you know, oh, it's got security risks. Look, there's more security risks on the street of Melbourne, I think. Somebody told me not to catch the trains at night. I mean, what's the reason for that? I mean, you know, we shouldn't be frightened of what we imagine is under the bed. We should really get there and meet them and listen to them. And that's the issue, isn't it?
You've touched on an important thing which links to the other question, and Jonathan might open that up for us. You know, the imagination which either liberates us to have compassion and generosity, or the imagination which makes us fearful and cut back on what we do because we think somehow that will be an advantage to us. So a lot of these things are about how we understand and imagine the world, how we imagine other people, how we relate their needs to what we know our needs to be. But Jonathan, talk through your understanding of the role of Christian faith in undergirding a conception of a society which is one where we work to alleviate some of these issues we've described.
Yeah. If Christianity is to instruct us in these sorts of questions, how we should act and behave, at its core it instructs us about what a human being is. It instructs us as to both the dignity of humanity and the doom of humanity and the destiny of humanity. So, and holding these things in tension, that there's this incredible dignity and value in human life, but also being profoundly aware of what we are capable of and our predilections to get things wrong as well. We need to hold these things in tension. But also being aware of who we are as humans. So there's the question of what is good for a human being, particularly the idea that the human is not an individual, and a human being has to exist in relationship with other people, a relationship with God, and relationship with the earth itself, with creation. So if we're to look at the health of the individual, we need to look at the health of the whole. We can't separate the two. And that's one core thing we need to instruct us in how we look at that, then how we think development happens. The next really critical thing is in the method of Jesus. Actually, if we're seeking change, how do we actually seek change then from other people, and particularly to pay attention to the dynamic of power? If we're looking for change, what brings real change? Dorothy Day said, famously, she said, actually, only love ever changes anything. She meant for the better. Only love actually ever changes anything. When do we expect people to change, under what conditions, and to what end? And we need to bring these questions into what is a human being and how we interact together. That's a short answer. Big question, though.
Archbishop of Melbourne, Dr. Philip Fryer, in discussion about the value of our overseas aid, our motivation to donate, as well as the political dynamics of overseas aid. He was talking with Valerie Browning, an Australian-born nurse and midwife who's been helping people and living in the Horn of Africa for 35 years, and Dr. Jonathan Cornford, aid researcher with the independent Christian organisation Manna Gum. You can have your say on overseas aid. Is the money well spent? Do we spend enough? Just search Big Ideas and Radio National, and you can post your thoughts on the comments page, or you can tweet us at RN Big Ideas.